On September 11th, 2024, Amaya Sangrenuse of the Bozeman DSA and Allison Sweeney of the Better Bozeman Coalition co-presented a talk on affordable housing overlays. The presentation was given at the Bozeman Public Library.
Alrighty, folks. Well, thank you so much for coming out here tonight to learn about an affordable housing overlay. This is co-presented by myself and Allison Sweeney, collaborative effort between Bozeman DSA and the Better Bozeman Coalition. And we really thought it was important to come together and co-lead this event and teach you all about this model because it's a tangible solution we have to address some affordable housing issues we're seeing in our community. And also we're representing a few different demographics. So I'm a renter.
I'm a homeowner.
So both of us experience issues with affordable housing in our community, and it's an issue near and dear to us both. So thank you all again for being here. Just a brief amount of background, and certainly this does not capture all of the reason why housing is so expensive and we're facing the housing problems we are today, but it does tell a bit of the story. So 2008 financial crisis, we saw a big shift from housing to be for housing and then housing as an investment. So we saw a lot of institutional capital begin to buy up hundreds of thousands of single family homes and multifamily homes in order to use it as an investment opportunity. So that was a big shift. And that really made our supply and demand equation for housing no longer localized, but really nationalized and even globalized. Maybe a few of you were at Patrick Condon's presentation just a few months ago where he introduced this concept, but he really saw Bozeman as a global housing market, and he saw that it was experiencing some global demand. So that's certainly setting the stage for what we're experiencing today. We saw in 2023, across the nation, 44% of single-family homes were purchased from private equity firms. So again, this housing as investment. And in Bozeman, we have a lot of speculative development. Again, we're a very attractive area for housing. We see a lot of national finance capital investing in our community, driving up our housing costs. And here's a couple of interesting statistics. We saw 50% of single-family homes and 60% of downtown condo sales in Bozeman so far this year were purchased in cash. So that's largely saying that the folks purchasing those homes are not those that are actually living and working here largely, but often these larger institutional investors. So today in our presentation, we're going to dissect some of these common narratives we see when we're talking about affordable housing, when affordable housing comes up in conversations. So what are those narratives? The first one we see is our zoning codes prevent a variety of housing types from being built. We actually have a very liberal zoning code that provides opportunities for a wide variety of housing projects to be developed. The second one is our zoning codes are preventing us from adding necessary density. As we'll see today, our zoning codes are pretty widespread, and the vast majority of the land that we have in Bozeman is actually zoned for those higher densities, our R2, our R3, and our R4 zones, as well as all of these mixed-use zones, R5, REMU, all of these other types of zones. And this is definitely one we see a lot. We just need to build more housing so the prices come down. As we'll see today, we've been building a lot of housing, and we haven't seen prices come down. And I definitely used to be in this train of thought as well, where I thought we need density and we need to build more at all costs. But now, since working with Allison, I understand that it's much more nuanced than just build, 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 and eventually we'll get affordability. We actually have to demand that what we are building is affordable. And we'll talk about how that looks.
Okay, so this evening we're gonna just crack open Bozeman's zoning code a little bit and get you acquainted with this. This is a map of Bozeman with its zoning districts in different colors. The first thing I wanna stress is that housing production is allowed in absolutely every zone. Industrial zones, commercial zones, we have several different residential zones, and we're actually allowed to build housing in all of them. So just to orient you here to the map a little bit, this is downtown Bozeman, the core few blocks of Main Street. This zoning is B3. This green is MSU, okay? And this right here is North 7. This orange, that's B2M, okay? So you can see I've labeled some of the residential zones. R1 is this pale yellow color. And you notice it is actually very conspicuously absent from most of the zoning in the core of Bozeman. R1 nationally is known as the lowest density zone and typically is reserved for single-family detached housing. Bozeman is a little bit unique in that we actually allow a variety of housing types in R1 as well. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. By acreage, the largest zoning designation of residential is actually R3, and that is this kind of darker purple color here. And that makes up 19% of the zoned area in Bozeman. Remember, all areas allow for housing production. So only 16% of Bozeman is R1, single family home, which isn't actually true in Bozeman. We need to have a very honest conversation in this community about private covenants, because single family zoning or R1 is often blamed or labeled as a privileged enclave that excludes people from living there. But what we see in Bozeman is that actually private covenants create privilege and exclusion, not our zoning. If you want to dive a lot more into the nuance of our code, whether it is permissive or restrictive, a BBC member just drafted a wonderful blog post for all of you data nerds out there. Please go dive in. It compares our code directly, provisions in our code with other college towns of the same size. To decide, you know, to show if we are liberal or permissive. And then it actually uses these national indices. I'll admit that part of it went a little bit over my head, but if you are into data and statistics, please go check that out and dive deep in there. Thank you. So R1 in Bozeman actually allows a variety of housing types. So cottage housing is allowed everywhere in Bozeman. I love cottage housing. It's really adorable. So we can actually build cottage housing in all the zones, including R1. You can also build an ADU in R1, and that can be attached or detached. So it can be inside your house. So you can actually effectively turn an R1 house into a duplex. And then, of course, it allows all these other uses. So you can have a rehab center, you can have cooperative housing models, you can have a foster home, you can have transitional housing, you can put a manufactured home in R1 as well. So, Bozeman's zoning code is actually not that restrictive, and it's not excluding anyone. The neighborhoods with private covenants, those covenants dictate. They're a contract between a buyer and a seller, and they dictate what kind of development can occur on that property. And they're usually managed by HOAs. And those covenants supersede any city code. So if there's a neighborhood built in the 90s or last year and it has private covenants, you can slap R4 zoning on that and it doesn't matter, because what the covenants say is what can be developed. So here's the other zones explained a little bit. They go successively more inclusive. So R2, on the left, you can have a duplex, townhouses, row houses, and then everything that was included in R1. In R3, remember, this is the largest zoning designation by acreage in Bozeman code, in Bozeman's map. And R3 allows up to an 8-unit apartment building. So Then things change when we get to R4. R4 does not restrict the number of units in a parcel. So subject to other code provisions, like setbacks, you can build an unlimited number of units within the building envelope awarded for development in that zone. And that will matter in a little bit. R5 includes everything, but also allows a little bit of neighborhood scale commercial in the same building, which is cool. Okay, so just to recap, like of all the land in Bozeman that's zoned for housing, R1 is this smallish piece. What was the community? Berkeley or something?
Oh, yes. Berkeley, 83% of their municipal zoning is R1. So,
okay, so
pretty much the opposite picture.
In communities like that, zoning is restrictive. That's keeping people out. Okay, but Bozeman's zoning code is actually quite liberal. Okay, and we are building. We are building and building and building. We're actually, per capita, we are outbuilding Austin, Texas. Everyone looks to Austin as this beacon of hope. And we are actually building more per capita than Austin. And we are building high density. So this is the housing that we brought online in the last few years, actually all the way back to 1980, if you want. but you can see color-coded, most of the housing that we're bringing online now is multifamily, but not only that, it's more than 5 units. So we are building more dense housing. If our zoning codes were indeed restrictive, that would not be the case. We would be seeing a lot of single family homes being built. And so.
All right, and so we're seeing a lot being built, but we're not necessarily seeing any rents coming down. I don't know who we have as a renter in the room, but my rent has sure not come down even with all of this development. So this is mostly to illustrate these kind of boom and bust cycles of investment in our community. We see low vacancy rates and high rents that are very attractive to investors to come in and build a lot of units, bring a lot of units online, and then we get a bunch of units, and sometimes we see that vacancy rate follow along with those units. But what we're seeing now is that we'll invest in this community, bring a lot of units online, and then leave, and then we kind of see rents plateau, not necessarily decrease as projected, but really plateau. And then we'll have perhaps lower vacancy rates with all of these units come online. But what we're seeing in reality is that even with so many additional units, we have incredibly high vacancy rates. This is from a City of Bozeman presentation from, I think, Economic Vitality Board. And we see, even though we've brought all of these units to Bozeman, we've been building so much, we still have this incredibly high vacancy rate. So what that communicates to me is that perhaps a lot of units are sitting empty. They are perhaps second homes. And also that they are unaffordable to the people that need housing. And that is also why we see this incredibly high vacancy rate, even with all of the development. So, well, if we build density, don't we get affordability? And what we are really trying to communicate tonight is not necessarily, it very much depends on how we do it. We need to be very tactful to ensure that our density is actually affordable.
All right, so the value of urban land is a very nuanced topic, but a couple of the heavy influencers are the demand, and I don't see that going down in Bozeman anytime soon. It's a beautiful place to live. And then another thing that affects land value is the development potential awarded to a piece of property. Zoning tells private owners what they're allowed to do with their property. And you'll have affordable housing builders tell you the number one barrier for them to bring housing online that is affordable is land price. when we upzone, when we grant more development potential to a parcel, we are signaling that that parcel is ripe for redevelopment, and before any of the housing can be built, the land price inflates because there's a profit to be made there. So these two pictures over here illustrate, say you have this little strip mall, maybe on College, over by the university, and your zoning restricts you to that little strip mall. The price of that property is going to reflect that. But if all of a sudden it is upzoned and you award development potential for five-story building with 100 units, that land price is going to go right through the roof. And what that's going to do is make it impossible for affordable housing developers to bid on that land. They can't even acquire the parcel. And then they have to deal with all the other problems. So nonprofit developers, a public developer. So if the overlay that we're going to present to you tonight, the idea is to grant additional density as an incentive to build affordable housing. But if the incentive is tied to affordability, ideally 100% of the new units be affordable, that's going to award development potential without awarding profit potential. So it's going to discipline the land value and make it more favorable landscape for our local small-scale developers to acquire that parcel. Nonprofit developers like HRDC, but there's lots more in the state. The land trust philanthropy model, these conditions would be more favorable to that. And then also social housing, which is the end goal.
Yes.
the overlay we're going to talk about tonight is incentivizing the housing we need if we redevelop. The affordable housing overlay is appropriate for redevelopment. The ordinance that we currently have and other tools can be used on greenfield development, but this is specifically for redevelopment.
So, you've been talking about this affordable housing overlay, but what actually is it? So, to begin, these are all the points that we hope to cover in the next few slides, but it is an additional layer of zoning over top our base zoning. So we have our base zoning, our R1 through R5, and all of our other mixed-use and commercial areas, and that can remain or be adjusted to reflect the actual reality of what's already built, and then we overlay additional zoning on top of that. It's an alternate option for redevelopment. So again, we're thinking about this to protect existing, already affordable homes and prevent them from redeveloping for luxury condos or the McMansions we're seeing, and again, disciplining that land value a little bit more. It is legal under Montana code, so unlike a lot of the common approaches that other states and municipalities have, like inclusionary zoning and rent control, we do not have those tools here in Montana, so we need to take some creative approaches that go beyond the ones that are commonly used in other spaces. Incentives under the overlay include increased density, not height. That is unique from the existing ordinance as well, that is currently incentivizing developers to give us a couple of affordable units and they can build extra height, but it is not inherently tied to density. Those are two distinct things. And what the overlay could do is provide strict design guidelines. So anything redeveloped in an existing neighborhood could be harmonious with that neighborhood and not be so incongruous like a lot of the redevelopment that we see where we tear down a cute single family or smaller home or duplex like we see on that wall and develop something that towers above all of the other homes in the neighborhood, but is much more appropriate so we can develop these more strict design standards so when these projects come online, come to be, there's not all of this pushback like we saw under our current ordinance, like with projects like the Guthrie. And again, not necessarily appropriate everywhere. We could develop a vision for how this would work with new greenfield development, but it really is designed for redevelopment. A lot of our existing affordable housing that is actively under threat to be redeveloped for that additional profit potential. So let's talk about what is naturally occurring affordable housing, or NOA. It's a term used to describe existing, older, smaller, already more affordable units. I know we all are understanding inflation right now, but it is much harder to bring something brand new. It will never be more affordable than what is already there. So a priority of ours is to preserve what is already there, and if we do redevelop it, that it must be affordable. That's kind of the goal here. It can be occupied by renters and preserves economically diverse neighborhoods. So something I've seen is a lot of mass exodus from Bozeman for folks that were renting something that was already affordable relative to all the new units that are out there. But then their landlord, the owner, redeveloped it to something that was luxury, and they immediately had to leave Bozeman and were displaced. So we're trying to prevent that from happening. And what do you want to add here?
I'm going to just add a little bit to the NOA conversation. This wall over here, I want you guys to take a look at that sometime at the end of the presentation. Go look at it closely. These homes are all in the landfill. Maybe some of you have heard the housing situation compared to a game of musical chairs. And when there aren't enough chairs, who are the people that get displaced? It's the most vulnerable in our community. Most of these buildings, these NOA, naturally occurring affordable housing, small, old, funky, they were rented. And there's a pretty direct line between demolishing naturally occurring affordable housing and the number of people we have experiencing homelessness. Some of these buildings were torn down in order to redevelop into McMansions and, you know, the fancy $2 million homes that we see cropping up in our neighborhoods. But some of them were torn down and the lots assembled, and large, you know, five-story housing as investment replaced them. This is displacement. There are several reports that suggest protecting naturally occurring affordable housing as a key component of our affordable housing strategy in Bozeman. And they suggest methods for protecting that housing. One of the methods is a floor area ratio requirement. This limits the size of a building that can be built on the lot. If we have a strict floor area ratio, you can't tear down a tiny house and build a McMansion. You are incentivized to keep the existing structure, whether that is for rental or some people like living in small homes. The reports also suggest another tactic is limiting the size of an addition you can put on these NOA units. Say you're a couple, young couple, and you're lucky enough to get into a house. Oh, now we're having a baby, and we actually need another room, or we need a bump out on the kitchen, or something like that. Allow for remodeling and for people to invest in their homes, but disincentivize the complete teardown and gentrification and redevelopment of these naturally occurring affordable housing units. Because if it's not a perfect home for you, if it's not a perfect structure for you, it will be a good structure for someone else. Downzoning. Consultants actually suggest downzoning to protect naturally occurring affordable housing. You downzone to match the structure on the ground so that it cannot be redeveloped for speculative interest. And then another one is the parcel assembly, like I mentioned before. If you limit the parcel assembly, that's going to regulate the mass and scale of things that replace NOA.
So let's take a look at an example, and we got someone here that lives right next to this development, actually. So what we saw was a naturally occurring affordable housing unit, and we got more density. Yay, we did it. Not exactly. We got more density. We got more units, but they were no longer affordable. So they were sold or valued at approximately $1 million each. So this is what the overlay is trying to prevent: losing affordability for density for density alone, but that density oftentimes not being affordable and will never be as affordable as what was there before.
We need to define as affordable, because that little brown house, I bet you that sold for over $750,000.
Yeah, so affordable is defined by the area median income, and affordable is if you're not spending more than 30% of your individual pre-tax income on housing. And we can talk more about what that looks like and how that's changed, and we'll have a whole question and answer period at the end.
Yeah, we'll have question and answer at the end. This house was also zoned R4. So yep. That development potential influences that land value.
Yeah, absolutely. This is you.
All right. So how does an affordable housing overlay differ from the existing ordinance? And we'll kind of go bullet by bullet here. The existing ordinance grants height bonuses, which is why we're seeing it in the higher density zones. You wouldn't use this in R1 because you would build a really tall single-family home, maybe with an ADU, that's affordable. So you're not going to do that. Grants a height bonus, so it's being used in high-density zones. Okay. The overlay grants a density bonus. So inside an existing structure, inside a structure that is allowed in the building envelope in a certain zone, that's a density bonus. You could put more units. The existing ordinance incentivizes the demolition of naturally occurring affordable housing if that affordable housing exists in a high density high density zone. Whereas the overlay is designed to incentivize the incremental density, the missing middle housing that our growth policy suggests that we're aiming for. The affordable housing ordinance is very attractive to institutional capital because they can build the mega buildings. Okay, so that's where we're seeing, you know, housing as investment, landlords, you know, corporate landlords, you don't get to meet them. They're probably using an algorithm to set your rent, and it's always going up and up and up. The overlay is designed to incentivize or be favorable to our local builders, our nonprofits, our public developer when we have one.
When we have one.
And then the current affordable housing ordinance was crafted with no community engagement. And the commission was in a really tight spot. The city staff was in a really tight spot. We were in the midst of two crises: COVID, a vacancy rate below 3%, crazy unaffordable housing, and the state had just taken away our ability to use inclusionary zoning. So they needed to do something. I understand. They needed to do something. But what we're seeing now, that those projects are starting to move into the communities, is a lot of conflict. And that's not healthy for us as a community. We all want to live here. We all want to be neighbors. We all want to be good to each other. We all need each other. So the conflict with robust community engagement to draft the design guidelines in the overlay, this is going to give developers a straightforward path. They know what they're allowed to do. The planners, they have clear definition. They know what they're allowed to approve in an expedited review. And the community doesn't worry, man, my house is in R4. Am I going to have a 5-story building right next to me tomorrow? Like, you know, it takes away the uncertainty. Nobody likes uncertainty. We want to know where we're going.
And this is your fun.
Oh, goody. Okay. All right, so if that was maybe not as clear, this is a visual of the difference between an affordable housing overlay and our current affordable housing ordinance. And I'm not saying there's not a place for the ordinance, okay? The ordinance gives us buildings like this. Insert spreadsheet of whatever bland box you like, but this is what the ordinance is giving us, okay? Maybe that's appropriate on major arterials, okay? But for neighborhoods, we need to focus on something that is more appropriate and that actually has the ability to give us the incremental density. So right over here, this is a naturally occurring affordable home. It's older, it's small, and it is in R4, which means it is ripe for redevelopment. There are whole neighborhoods that are zoned R4. Just because you see a single family home on the ground doesn't mean that's what that zoning is. So that's going to inflate the land value, and people are going to buy the lot, not the home. And we need those homes for the people who work here. So this actually is a home that is possible in R1. So R1 and R2 both have height limits of 40 feet, which is pretty tall. You can build three stories. You can build three stories everywhere in town. So in R1, even you can build a 40-foot house. This, I don't think, is 40 feet, but it's three stories. And there's five units in that house. And it's naturally occurring affordable housing. It's also in R4. A sad story about this property, actually. I wrote an article called Zoned for Teardown in Bozeman Magazine and found out that a member of our community tried to buy this property to save the workforce housing. They were preempted by a cash buyer. So it's probably going to be torn down. It's in rough shape. It's in rough shape. But anyway, so this is what the ordinance is giving us, right? It's a height bonus. So we're going bigger, mega buildings. Yeah, this type of building is going to end up in some portfolio as a line item investment, real estate investment trusts. I'm not sure this is necessary for our community. But maybe there's places where it won't do harm. This is what the overlay is going to incentivize. You get to build the house in R1, but it has five units. It has six units. Say you have an average 6,000 square foot Bozeman lot, and you can build a 3,000 square foot structure on there. That's big enough for five units. People are really into micro units lately. That's big enough for six units. So that's the idea of incentivizing. And the thing is, the density is the incentive, right? The density is the gift. So we're not requiring it. You can still do the base zoning. You can still, build a single family home if you want to in your zone. But if you're going to tear down and redevelop at a higher density, which we will gift you as the incentive, they'll all be affordable.
Want a ticket?
Yeah. All right, so every one of these reports, and there's dozens more, these are just the ones I've read. These reports all suggest protecting NOAA as a community resource. And protecting NOAA prevents gentrification and displacement. And they all stress that we design the overlay, the community designs the overlay for what is appropriate for them, for our affordability metrics, for our design guidelines to go with our neighborhoods. And this one here on the end is actually our very own Clarion Unified Development Code Affordable Housing Assessment from 2021. And I'm going to read you a quote from this assessment. This is on page 43. While most discussions of affordable housing focus on vacant land development and redevelopment, it is equally important to identify ways in which the Unified Development Code can be used to preserve existing housing and to reduce speculative pressures to expand or replace that existing housing with more expensive housing over time. Some of the proposals explored in this section are designed to limit both the net loss in number of small A affordable dwellings if and when some of these older structures are replaced with a larger number of units. And then they go on to have an entire section literally titled New Affordable Housing Protection Overlay District. These are consultants who evaluated our code. And these overlays are being successfully used in other communities like Cambridge, Vancouver, Portland, loads of others.
Yeah, it's a relatively new approach to incentivizing affordable housing through zoning, but we would not be the first place to try to make this happen. And I think that's important to know. There are many models. Some municipalities have 100% affordable housing overlay, so any redevelopment to add additional density has to be affordable at a level set by that municipality when they were writing the overlay. And other places like Portland have less than 100% overlay. So it gives us the flexibility when writing the overlay to make a structure that really works for our community and those that work and live here. This is something that has come up in conversations with the city commissioners, city legal staff, is the question of, well, is this legal? Can we do this? Because we can't do inclusionary zoning. We cannot mandate that developers develop a certain percent of units as affordable. We had that taken away in 2021. But we do have, all municipalities under Montana Code have zoning authority. So we can, through our zoning, do an affordable housing overlay. And this is the two sections of code that specify this, 762301. For the purpose of promoting health, safety, morals, or the general welfare of the community, the city or town council or any other legislative body of cities and incorporated towns is hereby empowered to regulate and restrict the height, number of stories, and size of buildings and other structures, the percentage of lot that may be occupied, the size of yards, courts, and other open spaces, the density of population, and the location and use of buildings, structures, and land for trade, industry, residence, or other purposes. So we have it written in our code that we as a municipality have zoning authority, so we can use a zoning overlay to provide an additional incentive to developers. You can do what's available in base zoning. If you want to go beyond that and add more density than what is currently available in that base zone, it has to be affordable. And so, again, writing the overlay, we can really create something that works for our community, but it would require extensive community engagement, robust public engagement in order to make it happen, so we don't end up with another model that greenlights projects that are completely inappropriate for the neighborhoods that they're designed for. So something really important, Cambridge, when they were developing their 100% affordable housing overlay, had over like 40 or 50 work sessions with the community, so really robust public engagement. Again, so when these projects are going through expedited administrative review, they are actually in alignment with the city's values and needs.
Their design regulations are 46 pages long.
Yes. So they have really extensive design regulations, which would be fabulous to write into our overlay to, again, make sure that if we are redeveloping, that that redevelopment is harmonious with the existing neighborhood. And we can require affordability appropriate to working class folks here in Bozeman. So again, affordability across the nation is set by that AMI, the area median income, which in Bozeman is $75,000. It's pretty high. But a high school teacher makes $44,000, and that's after the school board approved a raise. So what is affordable under our current AMI is about $1,875 for a single individual, but what is affordable for a lot of the working folks making closer to that $45,000 or $50,000 a year is $1,100, $1,200, and we are not seeing that reflected in what is currently being built. We would like to, this is kind of the nebulous part again, neither of us are lawyers, we're not pretending to be, but we would like to investigate opportunities to integrate environmental standards. Cambridge was able to integrate really robust environmental standards into their overlay. I don't know if Montana restricts our ability to do that, but I would like to investigate that. Integrate labor standards, so can we relocalize our labor force in these small-scale incremental developments? And can we require the use of a local nonprofit or public developer? That's all the things we would like to explore, but regardless, we need that extensive community engagement to write an overlay that is appropriate. So is affordability going to be set at AMI, or can we set a new affordability standard that is more appropriate for working folks in Bozeman? All right, so what needs to happen to actually make this function in Bozeman? So again, we are currently giving away density for free by upzoning. So the last draft UDC said, yes, let's upzone, let's have more density for density's sake, but did not require that additional density to be affordable. So we need to actually downzone a lot of these higher density neighborhoods and zones in order to have something to leverage. Because if there's a single family home in R4 and it stays R4, we have nothing to leverage. We have no incentives to give in the overlay model. So we need our base zones to really reflect more accurately what is on the ground, and not just give density away for density's sake, but tie it and require it to be affordable. So again, with an incentive model like the overlay. So we really need to tell our commissioners to implement this model, especially as we are rewriting our unified development code. This process starts Tuesday, next week, September 17th. So we hope to see you at that commission meeting, or we hope that you write public comment and we will give some more guidance on that. But we really need to work with neighborhoods to educate and draft this overlay that is truly appropriate for neighborhoods. So once we have an overlay and a developer submits a project proposal and it goes through that expedited review, it is actually something that we've all agreed upon as something that works for our community and is something that we need to see. An expedited review is one of those tools we have to make the funding make sense to actually put affordable projects online. So, your call to action after attending this presentation, stay engaged in the UDC rewrite process. Again, that starts next week. We would really love to see you submit or give public comment at the City Commission meeting, and then stay engaged with this process, because we are not writing the overlay here tonight. We're not going to write the overlay and have a beautiful overlay at the meeting on Tuesday. So really staying engaged with this process as we are writing and developing a unified development code that actually makes sense and reflects the needs of our community. And also get involved in your neighborhood association. Allison is a leader in our neighborhood association, but find your neighborhood association and get in contact with them, because we may need to downzone in order, again, to have that leveraging power in an overlay model. If we don't have our base zoning accurate, we have nothing to leverage and can just go ahead and build more luxury.
There's lots of conversation about downzoning. Most people's reaction is, oh, you can't do that. The city will get sued over that. There is one example in the proposed UDC where an area is downzoned, and someone with property in that area was not aware of it. So, you know, it is a tool that cities can do. They don't like to do it because they might get sued. So it's really important to gather the neighborhoods, people who are living or renting these NOAA units in high-density areas need to work together so that we have something to incentivize affordable development if they're torn down.
Yeah, awesome. So we do have this QR code. We also have printed versions of what this takes you to. But this takes you to our DSA link tree, and at the very top it says submit public comment, and it has a whole file of talking points four-year public comment that reflect what we all talked about tonight. So also just if you want to review some of these materials, we are happy to send this presentation out. But that talking point for public comment also captures a lot of the key elements that we presented on tonight. So
there's printed copies on the table back there.
Yes.
There's also a poster about the historic preservation program being rewritten, and several reports actually suggest using historic preservation tactics to protect NOAA. So if you're a renter, please fill out that survey and let people know what areas in Bozeman are special to you.
Yes. So we will, yeah, we'll take questions now. Thank you for listening. We'll go ahead and leave this QR code up for folks that still need to scan. But again, if you don't like to QR code, we've got written versions in back. So thank you. Yeah, any questions?
Yeah. Steve.
Me?
Well, Steve was first.
Can we get granular with zoning in the sense that, let's say, myself as an individual, my house is worth, you know, $1 million. I didn't want it to be worth $1 million. It's my home. I don't care what it's worth. Other people might disagree. But I want to say, as an individual in this house, I plan to live here forever or give it to my daughter. Can I downzone just my lot? And why not?
So there's spot zoning, and it's not a good idea. And I think it's actually not legal. So you really do need to work with a neighborhood. I'm not sure what the, like, size is. We can get some more direction from that, from Chris Saunders, who knows everything. I don't think you can downzone just your property.
It's not a spot, it's a square.
Right?
Good clarification.
You can de-restrict it, though. Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you could do that. Yeah, nice, Bob. Yeah, you guys did that. Yay! We're in the presence of a very good Samaritan. I don't know if you guys know that.
Yeah, totally.
Any other questions?
Seth? Yes, I was wondering how much y'all were paid to put on this presentation.
We did it for free because we care deeply about this problem, but we are also echoing a lot of the paid work that was done by the consultants 3 years ago for the City of Bozeman UDC rewrite.
Clarion was paid.
Yes.
We were not. We just read the report.
Yes.
Is there a way to get this presentation in front of the City Commission at the City Commission meeting?
Oh, at the meeting, I have no idea, but we are recording it. We do have one commissioner here.
Two. We got Joey.
Yay! Oh my gosh! Yay! Thank you for coming. Yes. So we have two commissioners. That's great. That's actually the maximum number of commissioners that we could have. So
yes. Yay!
But it is being recorded, so we will get it to the rest of them.
Yeah,
for sure. Hi, Joey.
Hey.
Yes.
I might have missed it.
Yep.
At the beginning, I came in a little late. What creates the affordability?
So the community, when drafting the overlay, decides what affordability to demand. What makes the affordability possible is the increased density. So instead of building a single-family home, you're building the shell of a single-family home, but you can have X number of units, 6 units. So it's really designed to work with our small-scale developers, our nonprofit developers, when we have a public developer, because our land value is so high currently that it's very hard to build anything affordable if there is also a demand for profit, for housing as investment, for, you know, shareholders taking a cut. So the smaller, local, one of our, is it the growth policy actually suggests investigating community housing funding models. I think Jen Magic is pretty into that and knows a lot about it, so.
But correct me if I'm wrong, it's actually much like the current ordinance, you put an AMI on it when you write the ordinance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's written in.
Yeah. And we don't have to use AMI. I know, like, Terry Cunningham brought up at a commission meeting a few weeks back. Do we need to continue using AMI? Can we develop an affordability level that is more appropriate to our cities? Because we do have such an inflated AMI that does not reflect a lot of the jobs that working class folks actually have. So writing the overlay gives us the opportunity to investigate if we should continue to use AMI or we develop a different level set for our community.
Did that answer your question,
Troy? I think a little bit. I just wanted to clarify that it's a similar tool to the current affordable housing ordinance.
Yes.
Similar.
Saying you can only build it this way. If you want to build it any more densely than this, we have to get this instead.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that it's the wager is somebody wants to rebuild something and would do it if they build a slightly larger structure that's chopped up into six units.
Yeah.
That's the incentive for affordability.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. That's what makes it possible.
Just a question, is the AMI just exclusively Bozeman residents, doesn't include the county at all, just Bozeman residents?
Our AMI for Bozeman is unique from the county. Our AMI in Bozeman is 74,111. So that is just unique. So if we are doing this overlay at a municipal level and it's not extending to the county, which I don't know if that model exists, it's very much city by city. If we were using current national guidelines for affordability, it would be based on our city's area median income, which is around 74.
And this AMI compares favorably with cities of similar size to Bozeman.
Our AMI is
really high.
Is really high compared to. We have a lot of folks making a lot of money here.
So AMI means half the people make more, half the people make less.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So AMI last year, we were at 60% of federal AMI of whatever, 109,000. Bozeman, we tend to be lower. Montana in general tends, my understanding, tends to be a lot lower than national others, towns and cities.
Oh, okay. So 74,000 is actually low.
I don't know where that new number came from, but maybe we have people moving in that are doing remote work, for example.
I think this is happening.
They
a lot, yeah.
are bringing that average up, but we still have a lot of people that are.
Yeah.
Not getting that bump. So that is a bit of a problem when you're using that AMI number.
Totally.
And you're getting kind of this artificial increase.
And 3 years ago, the AMI was $66,000. So our AMI has bumped up by $8,000 just in the last 3 years. So we do see it rapidly increasing.
So it's an inherently unstable metric, problematic. But, we could figure out some other metric that's more localized.
Yeah.
Maybe. There's been a lot of talk about that.
And AMI is how we deliver low-income housing tax credits and all of that stuff through HUD funding is all delivered and based on AMI. So that is what is commonly used when we're talking about affordability in housing spaces, but we perhaps have the opportunity to not use it if we don't find it to be appropriate or reflective of the actual wages here. Sorry, Emma, I know you had a question.
Thanks. I really appreciate you putting this presentation together. The current affordable housing ordinance, in addition to incentivizing by height, also incentivizes by decreasing the parking requirements, by allowing developers to rebuild their streets at the same time as they're building the structure, instead of building the streets first and then building the structure, and a couple other things building detail stuff.
Totally.
I'm just curious, in your all's concept of what overlay would look like, are those other incentives also included, or do you feel that density alone is a strong enough incentive to encourage people to build affordable housing?
So I think, parking, as we've heard from David Fine, it is the biggest lever. You can go watch community development board meetings where they speak for 5 hours about parking if you want to. But the one thing that I would want you to take away from this tonight is that if you are putting a building like this in a neighborhood with no parking, it's very easy for that neighborhood to absorb the 1 to 2 vehicles that come unparked in that structure. When you dump a 100-unit cruise ship on a neighborhood with 1 to 2 cars in every unit, that impact is huge. So there's a place for this, mm-hmm. but it's not everywhere. Yeah. So
we guess my follow-up to that is, in our current affordable housing, they might ordinance
yes.
an ordinance.
Or I know.
It's for the same letter.
Yes.
In the ordinance, we haven't seen anybody take advantage of that ordinance for small, like, single-family
right.
homes.
Right.
Or even, like, multi-unit homes, but, you know, the smaller type.
Really?
What makes you think that this would be different and that density would actually create incentive for developers that doesn't exist right now for height?
So this is targeting small developers, local developers, nonprofit developers, HRDC, land trust models, to do small-scale infill. This is not, we are not trying to incentivize big capital to come in and do these projects. So that's the difference.
Well, I would argue that the affordable housing ordinance right now isn't trying to target any particular type of developer. The
yeah.
hope was that
yeah.
all types of developers would find it useful, and it's just turned out that that's not the case.
Yeah.
So I know that, like, intent is wonderful, and
yeah.
we all have the best intention, but, like, how do you know that those smaller developers and nonprofits
yeah.
are going to be like, yes, this is it?
So there's a great Upzone podcast about this, an article where they talk about how a lot of large-scale institutional and developers looking to develop as investment will not be attracted to 10 to 20 small-scale redevelopments, incremental density increases, because that is, like, way too many projects to track. It's an administrative nightmare. It's a labor nightmare sending someone to each of those sites to manage that incremental density increase. And so it's much more attractive to these large-scale institutional developers to build one project where they can get 100-plus units out of it. So we see it, this kind of naturally being more attractive to folks that maybe have less money to invest into a redevelopment project, and also perhaps are not trying to do this all over town, but one project at a time, more incrementally. Yeah.
Yeah, I could totally see how this would prevent, like, one of those big developers.
Yeah.
But I just like to see more evidence that it's going to actually incentivize them.
Yeah. I think we need to go talk to the people who put tool bags on. I think, you know, because everyone in the housing conversation is, like, policy, right? Everyone sits at a desk and analyzes numbers and stacks these really complicated financial models on top of each other and all these different tools. But, you know, everybody's saying an ADU costs $300,000 to $400,000 right now. I have a neighbor who just built one for under $200,000. So, you know, we just got to go talk to our people who put tool bags on.
But isn't the answer also in examining the communities that have already done
absolutely
an affordable housing overlay? You said Cambridge, Mass. You said Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. If these places have instituted it, let's just see what the success level is.
Yeah.
So they are having a lot of success,
mm-hmm.
but they have public developers.
They can do inclusionary zoning.
$20 million land trust grants every annually from their city budget. They do have a lot more tools.
Yeah.
We're trying to lay the groundwork for those tools. And not for 1 minute should we let up on getting those tools.
Yeah. But they were able, just with the overlay, I think Cambridge had, like, 350 additional affordable units in the last 3 years.
Projects.
Probably better than creating a barracks for developers, workers, which was what the Guthrie was going to be.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Cherry picking the people who will be renting it. Ratcheting down the term of affordability to 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a total loser.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, anything can be better than that.
Yeah. We had a question in the corner.
Yeah. You know, we have affordable housing that was built out on Bridger Canyon Road.
Mm-hmm.
And those homes, I think, what are they selling for?
Market rate was, like, $675, and then the below market rate homes were about half that price in the mid 300s.
Half of that.
Yeah.
How many were there?
So this is the Bridger Creek or Bridger View?
Bridger
View.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it's called.
Yeah, the land trust project.
It's over by the mill and
yeah.
Bridger View. It's a wonderful development.
But I guess I'm asking about the price.
So yes.
And how many units were available, because the cost of building now is so high.
Right.
Yes.
I don't know, what is it, $300 a square foot or $400 a square
yeah.
foot?
Yeah.
It's so high.
Yeah.
So then that affects the affordability immediately.
Exactly. Yeah, so let's not make that land value go any higher, because already they're dealing with high labor and high materials.
And anybody who, you know, has worked on an old home, like I have and I'm doing now, with my daughter's house in Livingston, I mean, after a few hours you realize, wow, I'd just like to take this whole damn house and put it in a dumpster. You know, because it's so hard.
I think that's not the right house for you. We've spent 15 years on ours, and it's a labor of love.
We did wallboard, you know, sometimes there's no foundation.
Right, foundations are an issue.
And it becomes much cheaper just to take the whole house and throw it in a dumpster and start over again. I totally understand that, as much as I don't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not truly valuing the cost of those materials and the cost of the environmental impact cost of disposing of those materials. And it would be great to more accurately calculate that out. But yeah, that's not the world we live in, unfortunately.
Logan.
So for more clarification on the ordinance versus overlay,
yes.
To my understanding, the ordinance doesn't actually grant additional density. It's just the form, so height and parking. So it only makes sense to use it in R4 because there's unlimited units. Right?
All the commercial zones, the industrial zones, the high density zones is where. But where we run into problems is that actually a lot of the naturally occurring affordable housing is in those zones. So we're displacing people.
In the higher density R4 and R3 zones. Yeah, that are where the ordinance, existing ordinance is most often
attractive,
because we can develop an unlimited number of units, and then we also get extra height if we take the existing ordinance incentives. So that really is only attractive to folks already building 50 plus units. They get a little extra height and we get a handful of affordable units, but it does not feel effective or impactful.
Linda?
The question about what would make this attractive to local builders and not attractive to speculative builders. It's really important about the downzoning. And secondly, it's really important to get those other requirements in that you can't string together 7 lots and there are footprints requirements and ratio requirements. Without those kind of requirements, there's no...
Yeah.
It's volunteer. Somebody could move into R4 and still put in a huge box.
Yeah. So we have to downzone the NOAA neighborhoods to reflect what's on the ground and hopefully implement strict floor area ratio. A lot of the reports, like so many of the reports, recommended limiting the number of square footage you can add onto your house. So I had not come across that before reading those, but they all recommended it.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, too, especially when you look at the north side of Bozeman, you really need to get the buy-in from the people who live in that area. It's such a unique part of this town, and I'm sure that some people will not want to buy in. They're going to want to sell, they're going to want to buy a house speculative, and you know, I buy it for, say, $700,000. Well, I want to sell it for $2.5 million in 3 years.
Yep.
So, you know, how do you get all of that neighborhood together to come up with the same values that you're trying to implement?
And there is code that lays out the downzoning procedure. It requires 51% of owners in a geographic area. So it is going to take a lot of footwork to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Bob.
You mentioned at some point in here that this could prevent the McMansion problem, but I didn't hear how.
Floor area ratio. Actually, a lot of this is addressed in the Better Bozeman Coalition neighborhood-friendly unified development code report. That was a mouthful. It's on our website. But yeah, McMansions are definitely something that are getting a lot of attention nationally. And there was a great article about a bill that passed in Seattle recently, or in the last few years. And it's based on floor area ratio. So floor area ratio is a ratio of your lot size to the house you're allowed to build. Right now, R1 has a 0.5 ratio. So if you have a 6,000 square foot lot, you can build a 3,000 square foot house. R2 is a problem because that floor area ratio right now is 0.75, but with no guarantee of multiple units. So if you have a 6,000 square foot lot, you could build a 4,500 square foot single family home. That's problematic. So by making that floor area ratio smaller, in other words, you wouldn't tear down a house if you were only allowed to build something smaller. That's the reasoning behind it. So
I mean, I think of the house on the corner of Wilson and was it the one that Delaney tore down?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And that
well, that is a
that
whole can of worms, right there.
Yeah, I mean, whatever that thing is, I'm not sure that it's probably a little bit bigger than the house that was torn down, but not significantly,
right? Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, so there's not really any idea so far, other than the size thing to control
McMansions.
The replacement of something with something that's worth significantly more, even if it's the same size, if you put enough marble and
exactly.
stuff in it, right?
And I mean, we can't prevent everything, you know.
Yeah.
But we can disincentivize that kind of
thing. Yeah.
So have any of the overlays that you've looked at included environmental protection?
Yes, the Cambridge
like
one.
Like a tree ordinance?
Ooh, I don't know if they had a very extensive environmental report, and I did not see a tree ordinance in there, but if we're able to write environmental standards into this, it could go hand in hand with the tree protection that we're trying to do here.
That is something I want you guys to pay attention to when you go look at the NOAA on the wall. So many of those trees are also in the landfill. So that's setting us back on our urban ecosystem health. So.
Yeah. I would love to explore if under Montana code, we could legally require environmental incentives and also protection of naturally occurring affordable housing and old trees. I would love that. Yeah.
Something we get told as commissioners is that anything we add as like another requirement is going to make it like a less juicy deal for the
yep.
developer. And so we're always walking the line between like, yes, I want those environmental requirements.
Right,
I want
totally.
those building yeah. materials.
Yes.
I want there to be like space for storage for your toys. Like I want all of those things.
Yes.
And what staff will tell us is that means it's less likely for affordable housing to be built at all.
Yep.
So I'm just curious like what you all would respond to that one.
Oh, I 100% agree with you. Yeah. I mean, there's a limit to what we can
yeah.
incentivize and realistically get something back.
Yeah.
But maybe the NOAA has the little garage and the space for your toys and the mature trees, so don't tear it down.
Yeah, but it is kind of one of those things you see where it's like, can we require extensive labor standards if our goal is affordability? Like, where do those trade-offs have to come from? And Cambridge was able to do it. Cambridge was able to do it, but they also have a whole much more robust toolbox than we do. But yeah, it would be great to get it all, or you don't. If you can't give us good labor standards, protect these trees, build with good design materials, then you don't redevelop this at all. It's kind of the idea of the overlay. If you can't deliver on these things, you don't get to redevelop it. If you can, awesome. But writing the overlay will definitely like dictate what we can actually demand, and then if it's useful or developers actually go for it. But at least we then protect what's already there.
And it's not our job to make the deal juicy for the developer. It's our job as a city and the community
yep.
to make it affordable and livable to the community. And that's been a big thing that's been in Bozeman. Oh, it doesn't pencil out for the developers if we do this. It's like, we're only talking about the big developers. We're not talking about the little ones.
Yeah.
So it's not really our job to make it juicy.
It's our job to build affordable housing, though, right?
Yeah.
So we have to walk that line.
Isn't this whole thing supposed to be something juicy for someone?
Or so ideally, yeah, a small-scale local developer.
So the overlay actually has multiple purposes. The overlay is designed to protect naturally occurring affordable housing from speculative redevelopment. It's designed to lay the groundwork for our local and nonprofit developers to have a better shot at acquiring parcels that they can develop. And it's hopefully going to prevent gentrification and displacement. So it's not appropriate everywhere.
I just had a quick clarification of what you count as naturally occurring affordable housing.
So I think we need to do an inventory of our town. We need to figure out what we actually have, where are things zoned higher than what exists on the ground. Most of the NOAA that was torn down was rented. So that's rental stock that we can't get that affordability back. It may not be affordable for everyone to come in and buy it, but for example, my neighborhood, our homes sell for below the average. So is that worth protecting?
I would like to kind of give an example of a project I've been working on. Let's say the Bridger View, where the Guthrie was supposed to go. Let's say the overlay had existed there and it was downzoned. It was an R1 or an R2, but we have this massive lot, and it's depressed the land value as a result of the low zoning. And so, as a result, nobody's going to really want to spend a lot of money on it because the development potential goes down. But at that point, the city can speak with HRDC and its partners and other developers to say, hey, we have this unique spot here, or we have this unique parking lot. So instead of upzoning it, and putting it, seling it to the highest bidder, we reserve it for our community to use for density that meets the character and the desirability of our community. And so we house our people. And instead of it just going to a random developer who then dictates our culture and dictates our prices, and then it becomes an affordable, investment portfolio, which I'm sure they call it now. Let's look at our affordable housing investment portfolio.
And to clarify, who owns the property in this?
Sure, that's it. Whether it's the parking lot on Wilson, those two parking lots that now have the 111s, or whether it's the Bridger View that was owned by a conglomerate of a gal who lives in North Dakota. She owns all these places. She could sell this, but she could only sell it to anybody who'd see the development potential there, but we dictate the development potential to anybody that buys it at a deflated rate because we're not giving away that density on the front end. We're giving it on the back end. So it would be like, instead of it being, it was $2.4 million for home-based partners to buy it, it would have probably only sold for $1.2 million. And so at that point, you could be like, we could work with HRDC and other nonprofits, and it's a much more organic process. It doesn't fix our acute housing crisis. Mm-hmm. Our acute housing crisis will probably be fixed by the affordable housing ordinance. That just doesn't belong everywhere. The overlay protects and continues our cultural heritage. And I think that they can work in tandem, and we can draw out how that works, and we can work with neighborhoods and individual zones and districts to see if people have an appetite for it.
And so here's a really interesting insight I had into when I was going through the Guthrie proposals. They did one proposal that would end up with 42 units, and they were kind of funky, like some of them had 7-foot ceilings, but it was buildable under our code, and the rents ascribed to those units were actually affordable, like $1,000, $1,200, $1,300, and they were like, nobody would finance this project because it doesn't return on investment. And when I see that, I think, okay, what could HRDC do with that building? What could Homeward do with that building? When the goal is not the return on investment, but providing the community benefit. Just because it didn't work for that one developer with that financial model, does that mean it's unattainable at all? We don't know. Dan.
So would it be necessary or preferable to repeal completely the existing affordable housing ordinance and then replace it with an affordable housing overlay?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. We definitely see the ordinance having value in some like greenfield undeveloped areas where, okay, if you want to build 100 units and you'll give us 5% of them that are 60% AMI affordable, sure, that's great. That's what the addition, that the existing ordinance does. But the overlay, we could do it so it's just overlaying over the already developed parts of Bozeman. So we see these can working in tandem. We know the city has put a lot of work into the ordinance and they don't necessarily want to scrap it completely. I do think there's a lot of value in redeveloping the existing ordinance with extensive community engagement and with redevelopment in mind, since that's largely what we see it being used for anyway, and then have the overlay working in tandem to protect the already developed parts of Bozeman. So we can see it working together, but I do think the ordinance is flawed and could go about having a lot of additional community review to make it a better ordinance. Yeah, Emily, I know you had a question.
I think there's some good stuff here. I'm very curious what will happen when we all of a sudden disincentivize big capital. Like, does that free up some breathing room for local capital? Local capital, to me, that is a huge barrier. And doing these kind of incremental things is a scale of capital.
Yeah.
That being said, when it comes to affordability, the notion of being paid in scenery by living in Bozeman is not new. People have been opting into a cost burden life here for a while.
For decades.
Yeah. And so I think we have to be realistic about like affordability goals. I think we're going to get there only a few different ways. One is an increase in wages.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to know what median income is in the average, right?
Yeah.
And what the wages by sector are in Cambridge, because I have a sense that they're probably top tier or not, retail, hotel, restaurant, and construction.
Yeah. Right.
So that's going to be a problem to address. And so the one other way we can get there is acquiring property and using property that is not subject to market forces, like we do with schools.
Yeah. Yeah. Public developer. Yeah, totally. Yeah, we probably have time for about one more question. We do got to wrap it up at 7:30. So, gentlemen over there, do you have a question? Yeah, go for it.
A lot of the problem with the housing crisis here, I think, is that many of the homes are vacation homes.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to ski in the wintertime over by the golf course, there's not a single light on in 9 out of 10 homes. When I lived between College and Alderson on 6th, there were 4 houses immediately around me that there was never anybody there. Mm-hmm. The house next door, in 2 years, I saw the people there one night. The other house on the other side of me, they'd be there for 2 weeks out of the year. And the house on the other side of the street, on the other side of Alderson, I never saw them. So there's a lot of homes here that are just empty.
Yeah. Amaya, and I know this story well.
Yes.
Everybody else, and I think it reduces the number of homes where people can live.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, nationally, we have 15 million empty homes. Maybe it's up to 16 now. So
these houses are heated all winter.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So it talks about the CO2 output that comes from heating a home like all year round.
But this isn't on the north side where the displacement is most acute. Is most of the homes are occupied and have been and are occupied by people that have been there for 30 or 40 years and are on fixed incomes.
Yeah.
And most of them aren't educated enough to understand a lot of these issues and aren't represented here, as the south side is. And we're just getting bulldozed.
Well, this is, the north side is getting bulldozed. I just found out today my neighborhood is in the LIHTC census tract, so here come the bulldozers. But anyway, the great thing about the core of Bozeman is that it is economically diverse, right? We have renters living next to millionaires. We have you know, baristas in the loft apartment and the little funky brick house, and we have, you know, lawyers living down the block. Like, it's economically diverse. Everybody's mixed. But the more we remove this, the more gentrified it becomes, and we lose Bozeman.
We had one, a couple questions over there, and then.
Okay.
I just want to know, is this presentation going up on the BBC website?
Yes.
Yes, and if you signed in, we will email it to you once it gets uploaded on the internet.
Please sign in. If you're not already signed up for the BBC or the DSA, please sign up. Last question.
Okay, have you done any research on money? I know this is way beyond the scope, but, you know, a lot of these communities are using grant money and corporate money.
So there's a guy I really, really want to talk to, and I met him briefly at the housing conference in Missoula, and he's just a really super down-to-earth guy that puts tool bags on every day, and he developed a building called The Hogan. So go home and look up The Hogan in Missoula, and it's affordable housing for seniors. But the model, I think, could be applicable to other ages of people, but, you know, it's a 50% of the units are affordable at $1,000 a month. He didn't take one city variance, not one city incentive. He had community financing from a bunch of different members in the community, and Stockman Bank is the one who put it together. Those investors are getting 10% on return, so it's not charity, but they are taking a lower rate of return than purely speculative investment, because they know they're building something in their community. And if you go and look at this building, a third of the building is public space. Every floor has a full kitchen. So your unit might be small, but if you want to have family or friends over and make a big dinner, you've got a full kitchen access on your floor. You're sharing it, but, you know, it so people are figuring it out, you know? And that's part of relocalizing our finance. That was a local bank with local investors. And for me, that's really what I want to sink my teeth into, is that kind of financing structure. But anyway, okay,
right.
We have to actually start cleaning up because the library's going to go. But feel free to mingle for a few minutes.
Yes.
Please eat food.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for coming.
That was a discussion of affordable housing overlays presented by Amaya Sangreniz of the Bozeman DSA and Allison Sweeney of the Better Bozeman of the Better Bozeman Coalition at the Bozeman Public Library on September 11th, 2024.